Hello and welcome back to Classical Music Spotlight. I'm Raymond Bechet. That opening music was the very opening of Robert Schumann's First Symphony. And in today's podcast, I'm delighted to have for you an interview with Maren Alsop, the chief conductor of the ORF Vienna Radio Symphony, as she talks about her new recordings of the four Schumann symphonies as reorchestrated by Gustav Mahler. That conversation in a minute. First, here's a bit more of that opening music. So what is an reorchestration? It sounds like it could be a potentially dangerous operation.
It's so interesting because I think reorchestration can mean many, many different things. In the case of Mahler and the Schumann symphonies, it's really paying homage to Schumann because Mahler loved his symphonies, absolutely adored them. But he felt, I think, as a composer, that he could improve upon some of the instrumentation choices and dynamic choices and phrasing choices. And so he takes these symphonies, and in some ways, what he does shows us his interpretive take on these symphonies, you know, depending on where he edits the dynamics or rebalances things. And you know, when I first started on this project, I thought, oh, well, I'll just take my regular Schumann score and just add the things that Mahler changed. But then there's so many teeny little things, you know, like thousands, over thousands of things in each symphony that he changed. But I think he doesn't really change the essence of the symphonies. But I've enjoyed this project because it's showing me one genius through the eyes of another genius. So you get different perspectives on what they were both thinking. It's cool.
So Schumann was very well known for his small form and his Lieder, obviously.
Right.
Did he not understand the orchestra, or was he taking a while to come to grips with it?
I think there are a few different ways of looking at it. I think the Schumann symphonies are fantastic as they exist unto themselves, without any editing, without any reorchestrations. Of course, there was an inherent prejudice about Schumann's symphonies because he really hadn't written for orchestra much prior to writing these symphonies. So people come at it with a prejudice, I think, you know, that, well, how could he really know what he was doing? But they're very distinctive. They have a perspective, a point of view, and I think they work beautifully. But of course, Mahler's looking at these symphonies from his vantage point. You know, Mahler likes things heavier. He likes things more dense. Schumann, I think, has a more classical approach to things. And, you know, Mahler wasn't adverse to tinkering with the Beethoven symphonies as well. He did reorchestrations of many of those. But I believe it was more out of respect for these composers than a desire to change things. And I think it was from a conductor's standpoint, a composer's standpoint too, of course, but from his conducting standpoint, this is the way he looked at presenting these pieces. I don't think there's anything that requires tinkering with in terms of the original Schumann orchestrations.
So how much was that affected by the development of the orchestral instruments between when Schumann wrote and Mahler reorchestrated?
There certainly is a growth in the size of audiences, in the venues that the orchestras are performing in. Of course, the instruments are developing. I mean, when we go from Beethoven's time just, you know, into the Romantic era, we have huge developments with all the brass instruments, I mean, in terms of their chromatic ability, and their projection becomes much greater. Same with the string instruments, you know, everything's more tightly wound. And so their projection is much stronger. So I do think that we're kind of, things are going into turbo mode as Mahler enters the picture. And of course, Mahler, you know, he revved it up, you know, beyond belief, pretty much with his symphonies. And, you know, in terms of all the orchestration, in terms of the length of the pieces, in terms of the scope of the pieces, you know, he takes this idea of adding choir and, you know, adds choir and soloists and the blah, blah, you know. So for Mahler, I would say that more is always better.
So how did you first discover the Schumann symphonies?
You know, I fell in love with the second symphony really when I went on tour with Bernstein. And this is a long time ago, in 1990. And he performed it, and I opened the concert with Beethoven's second symphony, and he did Schumann too. And we talked a lot about the piece, and I really fell in love with it. And that really opened the door for me to look at all of the Schumann symphonies in a different way. And I've done them in a cycle, you know, two different nights, do Schumann 1, 2, and then 3, 4. And I've also collaborated with some mental health experts. In particular, I did a fantastic program with a colleague from Johns Hopkins University. And we discussed the issues of bipolar disease, because, of course, that was what Schumann suffered from, we think now in retrospect, and how the bipolar affected his mood swings and his compositions. And of course, he fell sadly several times into very, very deep depressions, and it was very hard for him to emerge from those. So, you know, I fell in love with the symphonies, but I also drew real sympathy for him as a human being, having to suffer so much in terms of his mental health and his mania, which was almost debilitating at some points. Of course, there are all the issues with the numbering of the Schumann symphonies, because the first symphony wasn't really the first symphony that he wrote. It begins with this fantastic, majestic, slow opening. And I should mention that this is nicknamed the Spring Symphony. So, you know, you expect it's going to start with a very flowery opening, but instead it's this regal, very slow, stately introduction. And then, as in all Schumann symphonies, some unrest seems to seep in, and that drives us to the Allegro molto, which is the main section of the symphony, which is very energetic. But, you know, the thing I try to point out in all of the Schumann symphonies is this sort of contrast of mood, that he can go from very almost hyper joyous too apathetic, you know, in the space of a very, very short time. And we can hear that already in this symphony, the Spring Symphony. For Schumann, a way for him out of his depression was always through counterpoint and, you know, sort of a la Bach, trying to organize his thoughts and his brain and anchor himself. And every symphony of his has some kind of fugal element at some point. So I always think, this is a way out. You know, he's put a little bit of a ladder over the side of the boat, you know, because he needs to climb down or climb up out of the depression. And we hear that, you know, in every single one of his symphonies. Also, he loved these codes in a way. So he would take his name or Bach's name or Clara's name and turn them into little themes, you know, hidden messages to everyone. And whenever you hear the descending fifth, that was for his wife, Clara, and that was her motive. And of course, that turns up in every symphony as well. Something that is also a hallmark, I think, of Robert Schumann, and of course it comes from his genius with song, is his melodic construction. And there's something about it that is very moving. You know, he doesn't usually use very small intervals, although in the first symphony, the slow movement is not built on all of these leaps, but in the second symphony, it certainly is. The slow movement has these huge intervals, but there's a lot of ornamentation, which is really referring back, of course, to the Baroque era, and lots of kind of filigree. And that feels very Baroque to me. The scherzo in this symphony is really a la Beethoven. It comes right out of that, that mold. But Schumann likes to change things up always. And you know, instead of one trio in many of his symphonies, he'll add another trio, which is a complete surprise. And I think that's, you know, that's just a testament to how he was taking the form, but innovating as well and thinking ahead. I especially like the coda in the scherzo, because it's quite unusual to have a coda in a scherzo. And it's a transition from that movement into the next. So, you know, Schumann's also thinking about the connecting points between the movements and creating almost a new type of form. And from that, we go to the finale, which begins again with this rather regal, slow introduction. And then again, manic joyousness comes back, which is, you know, it's just kind of fun. And I think Schumann is able to really push the fun factor almost to the point of absurdity, you know, because it's so active and so lively. But to perform, it's really a joy. The second symphony is the one that I first fell in love with. And this is a piece that Schumann wrote out of a deep, deep, deep depression that he thought he might never recover from. And maybe in some ways he never did. But at one point he started hearing the sound of angels, he thought, trumpets. And this is what opens this piece. Bum, 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 bum. And of course, it's always that fifth again. That's Clara's interval. And it's the sound of the angels over this very chromatic string opening, very forward thinking, almost heading toward bitonality. And these two elements coming together create something I think that we really haven't heard in symphonies before. So it's fantastic. And then in Schumann's typical way, he makes an accelerando into kind of this wild allegro that is over the top as usual. And this fanfare, this brass fanfare, will return over and over, not just in this movement, actually, but throughout the entire piece. So he's bringing in his own inner psyche as the piece goes. And I just find that so personal and so intimate in a way. We really are in touch with what he's feeling. This symphony has a very famous scherzo movement because it's on every audition for violinists. It's really hard. It's very fast. It's very virtuosic. And it's really fun to play. And it's great because almost every violinist knows it too. So it sounds good in the orchestra. The slow movement of the Second Symphony is one of the most beautiful slow movements I think ever written. And it's all about these incredible melodic lines with large intervallic leaps that are almost painful in their yearning. But in this movement, we will also hear sudden fugatos. You know, you go from these really singing, searing melodies to suddenly bum 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 you know, very, very Baroque in nature. And so we know that this is, you know, Schumann kind of finding his footing and getting his bearings. The last movement is just completely wacky. It's fast. It's unison at first. It's scales. It's really, again, just this incredible kind of manic high that Schumann has. And he starts playing with the inner rhythm. So it's not just a movement in two, but at some point it turns into kind of a 6-8 feel or a 6-4 feel. And he brings all of these elements together from the whole piece in the end, including, of course, that opening fanfare, which comes back for the climax of the piece. Schumann's third symphony, which is nicknamed the Rhenish, is, I think it's a tour de force in terms of rhythm and rhythmic ambiguity. It begins, so it's the idea of a hemiola, which is really, you know, it's not the rhythm you're in. It is changing the rhythm over the bar line. So, I mean, you don't really need to know what that is to feel it when you hear the opening of this symphony, but it gives it a propulsion and also a restless quality that could be very, very illustrative of the idea of this Rhenish experience. You know, his location was important. His job was important. He was very influenced always by external things. And we find that, you know, very apparent in all of his symphonies, all of his compositions, as a matter of fact. But this piece for me is all about this rhythmic ambiguity. And perhaps, you know, it reflects his mental state, this sense of unease, and also the fact that he had to relocate and he lost this job. And, you know, things were never easy for Schumann. And yet then we go to the second movement of this symphony, the scherzo, and it's more like a Ländler, you know, this kind of lumbering Germanic dance, and it's very happy, it's very sort of paternal in mm-hmm. nature, which I love. And he goes back and forth, of course, as Schumann always does, between an incredibly contrapuntal alternating section and then this melody, which, you know, back and forth. And you can almost hear the peasants singing this out in the mountains, you know, and it resonating over and over again. It's wonderful. The slow movement of this symphony is also, I think, very special and very intimate. It's a movement that I think, for me, is very Brahmsian in the sense of chamber music. You know, the internal movements in the Brahms symphonies are much more chamber-like than the external movements. And I feel that very much in the slow movement of this symphony. There's lots of bum, 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 the kind of, you know, just intimate whispering back and forth. and it's quite introspective. And that leads to the fourth movement. I mean, this symphony is unusual because there aren't four movements, there are five movements. And, you know, that's quite a departure for a symphony. I mean, we have to remember, you know, it's really breaking tradition. And this movement features the trombones, which still in Schumann's time are somewhat of a specialty instrument. The trombones were employed often to represent the spiritual in music. And this begins with this trombone chorale. And the sound and the quality, it takes you really right to the cathedral, you know, and it's just so different in many, many ways. And the tempo marking is feierlich, which means solemnly. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there is a sense of religion or maybe ceremony about this movement. And of course, we always have the sense that it's leading somewhere and it keeps gathering momentum until the fifth movement sort of breaks out. And it's really a happy way for Schumann to wrap up this symphony. And I think we get a feeling again for Schumann's inner world that it was tumultuous. You know, he could feel so deeply, so intimately, such profound emotion. And yet then suddenly he would be running and, you know, almost uncontained in his joy. And that's what we definitely feel in this finale. Now, the fourth symphony, this introduction of the first movement is all about rhythmic ambiguity, which we've now seen in the third symphony. We've seen it a little bit in the second symphony. And so we don't know whether we're in 3 or whether we're in 6-8 or what's going on exactly. And that ambiguity runs through the entire piece. As usual, he makes an accelerando into the faster section, which is the main section of the piece. And this is a theme that it's all 16ths. So he's bringing together that counterpoint and that contrapuntal texture with this sense of mania in this piece. So we see in this symphony, and we see a lot of these elements coming together in this symphony. I think what's so interesting is that there's no pause between the first and second movements. It goes right into the second movement, and it's not called andante or largo. It's called romanze, and that's so nice, you know. And ziemlich langsam, you know, just quite slowly, but you know, not deadly at all, and it's scored for a solo cello and an oboe. We see this so much in the symphonies of Brahms as well. And of course, Schumann was Brahms's mentor. and idle in many, many ways. And so we see perhaps that's what Brahms was thinking when he wrote those inner movements that are so chamber music-like. But this rhythmic ambiguity continues all the way through this movement and even keeps going through to the scherzo. And, you know, as we would expect, we have some playfulness in terms of the trios and what happens toward the end of the scherzo. He's really turning things around. He's taking the ideas of the scherzo that Beethoven created, and he's now adding sort of this romantic bent to it. So at the end of the scherzo, he starts to slow it down. And then we have a transition. It's not the finale really, but it's a transitional section to the faster section of the finale. And that's quite unusual. So the idea of a continuous symphony without pause now exists. And it's really quite fascinating. He's got one foot in the past and he's got one foot looking toward the future. And that was Schumann's gift, I think, that he wasn't tied to tradition. He didn't feel obligated in any way to play by other people's rules. And that's what I love about Robert Schumann. He's a rebel. And also someone who spoke up in support of other artists, other composers. You know, he was a person of great integrity as well.
For somebody that's coming to this from a completely different musical background,
mm-hmm.
What would you have them think about as they want to reimagine a piece of classical music?
You know, I think that today we are too married to the idea of the sanctity of the canon. You know, in the old days, for example, Mozart said, "Oh, I like this Handel Messiah, but I got to update it a little bit." You know, so Mozart did his own reorchestration of Handel's Messiah. And this was something that was sort of pro forma in mm-hmm. the old days. You know, composers changed things. They improvised. They let things evolve for the different times. And I think sometimes we in classical music, we get too stuck in a rut, you know, about it has to be this way. Can't be that way. I'll never forget when I was playing Handel Messiah and a friend of mine said, a non-musician said, "Oh, you know, I like it when they stand up, but it's too long until then." And I started thinking, well, maybe this is a piece that needs to be updated. And so that became a passion of mine. And I, with two arranger friends, I created Too Hot to Handle, a gospel messiah, mm-hmm. you know, and and it's a huge hit, but it keeps the integrity of the essence of the piece, you know, the basic DNA, the same, but it infuses it with life for a new time, you know, that's influenced by the music that has come after Handel and as a result of Handel as well. So I think that composers would be flattered to have their music looked at through a different lens. That's, you know, maybe I'm just justifying it, but I think they really would be. I think Beethoven would not be shocked. I don't think Handel would be surprised. And I think Robert Schumann would be thrilled that Mahler took the time to really look at his symphonies in this way.
You have been listening to an interview with Maren Alsop, chief conductor of the ORF Vienna Radio Symphony, and to music from their new recordings of Robert Schumann's four symphonies as reorchestrated by Gustav Mahler. Both albums are now available. Symphonies number 1 and 2 are on Naxos catalog number 8.574429, and symphonies number 3 and 4 are on Naxos catalog number 8.574430. My thanks to Maren Alsop for speaking with and sharing her thoughts with us about Robert Schumann and this great music. We will be back with more Naxos Classical Spotlight podcasts in the coming weeks. Until then, I am Raymond Bechet. Thanks for joining me. So long for now.